Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the next Walkabout Talk About. I'm Lucas Martel, creator of Walkabout, and we have today Jeffrey Travis from Positron and old friend, from back in the Austin days. And Jeffrey, why don't you go ahead and I'll let you give your bio. You'll do such a better job than I will.
Sure. Thanks, Lucas. Thanks for having me. I'm Jeffrey Travis. I'm the founder and CEO of Positron. We're a virtual reality company that focuses on cinema, and our main product is a motion VR chair that we install in places like museums, tourist attractions, family entertainment centers. So we also produce and license VR films. So my background is as an engineer. I studied at UT Austin and then went into filmmaking as a writer-director. And we've had our company for about 10 years now. So, and I guess, awesome. You and I met back in Austin, back when we were both doing films. So,
I was going to say, but you actually got into VR shortly. I mean, you've been doing VR for a long time. Like, it was probably, was it like the DK2 or it was?
Yeah, DK1 actually. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, 2014, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and it was definitely maybe, the early days.
Yeah, maybe you could also just sort of like give people a little context too, because what you make is really, really unique. It's sort of like it is a chair with hydraulics and all these different motion abilities. So maybe you can pitch that a little bit better than I can as well.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so Positron, our Voyager chair is essentially an award-winning VR chair that was the first chair designed for VR with full motion. So it's a motorized chair that does full 360 rotation. So you can do unlimited yaw in either direction, has pitch, integrates haptic feedback into the pillow, and also has a scent dispenser. So we essentially try to integrate more multi-sensory experiences. It was designed with some neuroscientists that were part of our team to particularly alleviate any sense of motion sickness that some people experience. And it's really designed to kind of be the smoothest, coolest. You know, people sometimes compare it to soaring over California or Star Tours, if you've done some of those rides, combined with, you know, the sensation of being inside of a film. We've installed these in, I guess, over 160 all over the world, Asia, Australia, Europe, and the U.S. We've had over 130 films that have been ported to our platform, and we've worked with both independent creators as well as studios like Universal, Disney, and DreamWorks to make content for it. So,
awesome, yeah. Well, here, if you want to go ahead and kick us off, and I mean,
sounds good.
One little.
I guess I go first. Yeah.
Yeah, go for it. The very first thing I think when I came out to your office in LA, this must have been like six, seven years ago. You were doing it was the Dragons. Was it Race to the Edge? I'm trying to remember the name of the specific
one. They had a train to your dragon. Was it the DreamWorks? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And that made a big splash because that I remember was in a bunch of like they were on doing a big tour. A lot of people, I think, wasn't it Walmart that had a ton of them that would sort of like they would move around to different locations and let people check out, I believe.
Yeah. So that was a project we did with collaboration with DreamWorks and Walmart based on the How to Train Your Dragon franchise. And super fun. We ended up – oh, nice work. We ended up doing a portable – essentially a touring VR theater of chairs that would be set up in Walmart parking lots, and they'd go around the country. So guests would come in, sit in the chairs, do the experience, feel like they're flying with their favorite dragons, you know, and Toothless and the characters from the film, and then get out. And we also incorporated wind effects into that one, which was kind of fun. So we had directional wind with some fans around. So as you were flying with the dragon, you could, you know, feel the wind on your face in addition to all the other sensations.
Yeah.
And then people would exit through a gift shop that Walmart had set up with all the merchandise from the film. So, super fun. That one ended up winning a Lumiere Award, and it's probably still one of our best pieces of content we've ever had for the chair.
I remember the thing that really sort of amazed me about that one was sort of like it's easy to sort of say like, oh, yeah, like alleviate motion sickness. But this was essentially a roller coaster in VR. And I did not have any motion sickness at all. And at that point, I was still really new to VR, so I hadn't done a whole lot of it. But one of the things that was so interesting about it was sort of the how little input it took. Like if your body turned or tilted just a little bit in the direction that it felt like you were supposed to go, your brain filled in so many gaps. It was really surprising.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the interesting things we learned about combining physical motion with VR is essentially it takes very little to create a strong sensation. And so you can essentially amplify, right, with what you're mm-hmm. seeing in the VR camera. So for example, if the chair, like you were saying, just tilts back a little bit, but mm-hmm. in the VR environment, you're being blasted back. Your brain is convinced, you just went through like some G-forces, which is really fun. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of those strong sensations, of course, is to ensure you don't get motion sick. So that's where a lot of the science of getting very smooth motion and make sure the camera moves, of course, are adequate mm-hmm. too inside. It's kind of, both things, both the chair and the content doing it right.
Totally, yeah. So when did that, because that would have been probably a lot of people's very first VR experience, because you guys were doing, you said it was DK1, but that was like, when did that particular product start to launch?
Yeah, that was a little later. We started working on it in 2018 is when that came out, and that launched mm-hmm. around then. For a lot of people, it was their very first experience. I think what's interesting too is that, they didn't, I don't think anybody expected it to be as popular as it was. It was meant to be a promotional piece for the feature film that was coming out mm-hmm. from DreamWorks. So they didn't try to monetize it. It wasn't like they were selling tickets, but people would drive from 3 hours away, right? They'd hear about it, come to the mm-hmm. Walmart, there'd be like crazy long lines, and then mm-hmm. Sell out within minutes in terms of all the slots available. So it's one of those things where we saw, wow, this is actually,
nice.
There's something to this. And that was kind of the beginnings of how we started thinking about having an LBE business model around this, seeing just kind of the joy and delight that even mm-hmm. a short 5-minute experience could bring people.
And that was definitely, again, just to sort of like, if you haven't tried it yet, it's the closest thing to like being on a Disney ride that I've ever experienced without all of the infrastructure of all that. So it is extremely, extremely polished experience. And just, like the amount that you're able to do with a device that is essentially mobile that can be shipped around the country. I mean, I'm sure that's not sure that's not easy, but I know you've brought them to South by Southwest and a bunch of different festivals and all that. So it's a really, really cool experience. So I highly encourage people to try it out if they get a chance.
Yeah, thanks. I think that is one of the things that the feedback that we got was that this is you now. We realize, we the technology makes it possible now to essentially create much smaller footprints of what essentially was, like you were saying, it's very similar to a big theme park ride, right? Which mm-hmm. would be millions and millions of dollars a year or two at least to install and set up, and these chairs can, with the right kind of content, can recreate that sort of magic and experience, and you can really put it anywhere. And so that's one of the things we're excited about. We saw like, here's an opportunity to kind of bring mm-hmm. that Disneyland type experience without having to go to Disneyland. We can bring it to you wherever you are.
Yeah. So maybe kind of talking a bit more about like the larger stuff that you guys have been doing then. So at that point, when that you mentioned the Dragons was one of the ones that sort of got you thinking more in that LBE, which, by the way, when we say LBE, it's location-based entertainment. So that would be like VR arcades or theme parks or different things like that. You guys, with what you were building, you must have been sort of like thinking around that, but how much did that sort of change like your business model or how you were going about stuff and thinking about stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely designed a chair, didn't think of that really as a home device from the beginning, just because of the size and cost, at least initially. Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, we've had a few people, more like some Hollywood producers and actors buy one for their home. But for the most part, we thought, this is something that, especially at the time we were starting, a lot of people had never tried VR, and the Quest didn't even exist yet, right? So it was... Yeah. It was something where like it was a real novelty for a lot of people to even try VR, but then to see it in a capacitor where they can sit down and go through this motion experience, just to us, it made a lot of sense from a business model, because we mm-hmm. saw people were more than happy to buy a ticket and feel like they had a very satisfying experience, have that mm-hmm. Disneyland ride. So then it was a matter of looking at where does it make sense to put these kind of chairs, and what we found is, let's go to places where there's already what we call lots of footfall, right? People are already going to look for something or be entertained mm-hmm. or learn. And so museums, cinemas, you know, tourist destinations, those kind of traveling mm-hmm. exhibits, those kind of became the main partner that we would look with. And what we found is, you know, anywhere between 20 and 50% of the people that were already there would be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go check out those VR chairs. That experience looks great. So it made sense for the operator of the LBE, and it made sense for us.
Cool. And I'm also kind of curious. I feel like I always love doing these just because, like, we've known each other for a long time, but I never really get to sort of like kind of like actually pick your brain at the sort of like at some of this more granular stuff. So I like doing these as much as anybody, I think. But I'm kind of curious how, because I mean, you were using VR, but really the like how much would you consider that it was sort of like VR focused versus you were almost making a separate product that was or wasn't even directly related to the VR aspect of it?
A lot of the chair, of course, doesn't have anything to do, you know, the motorized system, right? Anything to do with VR directly. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it was really just about, you know, the impetus for this was two things. One is, you know, most people were coming at the time, and, you know, probably still do, obviously, like your company, right? From a gaming perspective, very interested in gaming. So I love games. Mm-hmm. We all play games. But as a filmmaker, I was really interested in just the niche of what are cinematic experiences in VR like? And, you know, we tend to watch that kind of cinema always seated, right? It's not an mm-hmm. interactive experience. And so to have something that made you feel with the VR technology, which for some people could feel intimidating, the headset, especially tethered VR with wires going around your head, just kind of the whole setup. I know that a lot of people would, especially the demographics that we see in like museums where you have people that are 70 years old trying this or, you know, mm-hmm. all ages, would not strap on all this gear and go start hunting zombies in VR.
Right.
But they love the idea of sitting in a comfortable chair, something that looks familiar, feels like a theater, something that more futuristic. So the idea is to kind of package the VR mm-hmm. experience in a way that felt somewhat familiar, but also gave them something new and different. And because people can relate to a theater or cinema, they would see our chairs and say, oh, you know, that looks like something I've seen before, but it looks different. Let me try that.
And you mentioned museums and a couple of other things. Like, what is the sort of breakdown as far as sort of like entertainment or more sort of like that one-off arcade versus more like museums and educational? Like,
yeah.
How does that break down?
Yeah. So I would say that it probably breaks down. I would say about a third. Probably three broad categories. A third. So I'd say a third of our installations and content is more the museum edutainment, right? So we have like a film that's being shown in Sydney, Australia right now. It's Australian Museum. It's on a world tour for 5 years. It's called Ramses and the Gold of the Pharaohs. It's about King Ramses, and it's tied to a museum exhibit around King Ramses. And people go into the chairs, get to feel like they travel back in time. You know, we had another one about Machu Picchu that traveled into museums. The mm-hmm. Boca Raton Museum of Art, the San Francisco de Young Museum, along with the Machu Picchu exhibit. And this experience, again, took people to the top of Machu Picchu. They could actually smell the plants up there, smell the fresh mm-hmm. air, feel like they were actually there. Then a third, I would say, fall more into the tourist flyover experience. So, for example, we have a permanent VR theater in Melbourne, Australia, that's in the tallest skyscraper in Australia called the Skydeck, Eureka Skydeck.
Okay.
And that people gives a Melbourne flyover. So people feel like they're flying over Melbourne, seeing the iconic sites, and for tourists, right, which is a big business, they really get a sense of, you know, it's just like soaring over California, they're soaring over Melbourne, but virtually.
Yeah.
And then a third would be, more the entertainment, right, more like just fun. You know, we've licensed films like the How to Train Your Dragon. We've worked with like studios like Baobab, which has made a series of animated films, and Asteroids Invasion. They have some other more recent ones as well, and those are really popular with families. You know, so I guess it breaks up to about those three categories more or less.
Yeah, pretty evenly. And now I'm also kind of curious because I know you like it kind of started as sort of like a. I know you did a good bit on the hardware side of things, but like talk a little bit about sort of like creating content Like, essentially, now these are 360 videos, or they're 180 videos, or is it all rendered in engine, or a mix of stuff?
It's a mix of stuff, yeah. So we've done both 360 and Unity and Unreal 6 DOF experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say that the 360 is always a little bit easier for us to work with and program. You know, it doesn't require as high-end computing power. But then there are pieces of content that creators make, like the Machu Picchu experience I was mentioning, mm-hmm. that really we're done with photogrammetry, we're done in engine. Are meant to be a 6DOF experience because you're looking at, say, for example, ancient artifacts, right? And you want to be able to, like, get a little closer, even though you're seated and you're not walking around, you know, mm-hmm. even just being able to move a little closer to the artifact and see its details creates a more wow factor. So, yeah, we have an Unreal and a Unity SDK built for Positron, so developers can essentially integrate that SDK into their content, and then it'll let it talk to the chair, and we can program the motion for it.
Okay. So how much of it is stuff that you guys basically kind of work with third-party developers to create stuff like that, or how much are you actually creating yourselves? Because it is such a custom experience, it seems like.
Yeah. The majority of it is from other creators. You know, we essentially see ourselves as one of the ways we serve creators is to be a distribution platform for them. So mm-hmm. Particularly with cinematic VR, right? There's not a lot of places where it can be broadly shown or certainly not monetized where creators make. So Positron is really one of the places where the right piece of content has, for some creators done very well financially, mm-hmm. Just because obviously, you know, lots of people, thousands of people coming in every week, paying $20 a ticket is different than a $3.99 download, you know, on the
right.
the Quest Store, the App Lab, if you can even find their piece of content. So mm-hmm. it gives us a chance to elevate it and put it into place. You know, we have produced some of our own content. Last year, did a piece called The Secrets of Tutankhamun. We went to Egypt with the permission of the Egyptian government, got to go into King Tut's tomb and scan all of that. We have it's a flyover experience to the pyramids and Valley of the Kings and super fun. And that's been showing in a traveling exhibit with Nat Geo that's been went around the US last year and is showing in Mexico City at the moment. But yeah, I'd say it's about 90% content we license from other creators and then some of it we produce ourselves.
Okay. And then you guys are able to sort of like take it over and sort of like you mentioned programming in the moves. And I'd imagine there's a decent bit of kind of sorcery with that isn't right. as much about feel or as much of as because you obviously you're not able to match things one to one. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. The motion of the chair, we've learned a lot through trial and error and experimenting with different things. Mm-hmm. One of the very first pieces of content we had to program motion for was a Universal Studios project that was a behind-the-scenes 360 film for The Mummy. If you remember the Tom Cruise film, The Mummy, that came out a few years ago. Mm-hmm. There's a stunt he does in a big airplane where, you know, the plane is going into a nosedive and crashing, and so he and his co-star are just kind of flying around, right, in zero gravity, and he shot that in an actual zero gravity plane, you know, one of those airplanes that goes up mm-hmm. high and then just does a free fall. And so they use a 360 camera to capture that. And we really worked at like, how can we recreate that sensation of floating? Like, feeling like you're in zero gravity floating there next to Tom Cruise. And then also going that sort of like sensation of falling when you go back into gravity again. And I think we kind of got it right. A lot of the feedback was like, wow, this actually made me feel like I was floating and then fell. So I would say the motion is not just always about following the action or trying to replicate one-to-one. It's also about creating sensations that mm-hmm. are coherent and match what the story is trying to tell you. The other reason to do motion is to let the creator use it as a panning device. So when you're in cinematic VR, mm-hmm. You know, you obviously don't have the user as agency. They can look anywhere they want, and that's still true in the chair. But
right.
when people are seated, they tend to mostly look in front of themselves, maybe with 120 degree pan, right, left mm-hmm. to right. So by rotating the chair, we can sort of force viewers to look in a certain direction. And also it's using some of the same language that cinema uses, right? When you have a pan to reveal something, for example.
Yeah.
There's a great little horror VR piece we have where the chair, you can hear a monster behind you. You haven't seen it yet. And it's scary. And then chair slowly starts rotating, right? And you know that at any moment that monster is going to come into frame. So it creates a far more scary experience of something you might do in a traditional film than if you just let the user look wherever they want, right? Or stay.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah.
I had a little more trouble with this hole.
I was going to say, yeah, made a point whenever we record these to try to not do, like, as much as I love Upside Town and Laser Lair, that, like, if you're really trying to contend with, like, the more puzzly holes, it gets a little challenging.
Right.
But still, golfing and talking at the same time is a little more challenging. So, yeah. So, coming from a filmmaking background, sort of like, which side do you personally sort of like connect the most with or spend the most of your time doing? Is it more the content side, or is it more, are you doing more of the, like, kind of biz dev, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, it's been a little bit of everything, but the content side is definitely where I spend more of my time lately, you know, working, meeting new creators, working with content creators, going to film festivals. And, you know, what's funny is that we discovered is that working with, by putting the artists first and the content creators first, that's actually helped our biz dev a lot, even though the content creators are not really in a business sense our end customer. It's the locations that install the chairs. What we found is that by working with content creators and insisting on elevating our quality standards, the artists really respect that and want to work with us. And so then those artists will insist on, you know, with a certain location, hey, I want this shown on Positron. And a good example of that is we work with an artist named A.R. Rahman. He's very, very famous in India, two-time Oscar winner, did the soundtrack for Slumdog Millionaire, winner of multiple Grammy Awards. So he made a VR film. It's actually one of our longer ones, 38 minutes long.
I was going to ask what the average running time was, but 38, that's a decent chunk of time.
Average is about 10 to 12 minutes, but 38 is definitely longer. But he's from the beginning insisted this only can be shown on Positron chairs. And so we've had opportunities to place VR theaters for exhibitions in Toronto, LA, Cannes Film Festival, working with him. So I feel like that's been it's been a great strategy for us to sort of like we make this about the content and the artist first, and then, you know, the business side seems to naturally follow.
Cool. And I'm kind of curious, sort of like, you've been in the industry for quite a while now. You've sort of seen all of the ups and downs of VR, though it also seems like you guys have kind of been charting your own course that's largely been independent of a lot of the VR stuff. Or do you feel like there's been much of an impact with sort of like VR becoming more popular? Has that had a good, bad impact on things?
I think it's had net good. I would say, you know, probably a few years ago, VR was a little more unusual or more of it was kind of the novelty factor. You see a lot more VR and obviously a lot more people have Quest. So there's probably a little bit, it means that we just have to differentiate ourselves a little more in terms of it's really about the content, right? As opposed to like, ooh, look, there's a cool VR headset and a chair over there. It's more about like marketing the content. The shift I've seen is probably 5 years ago, we were marketing the chair a lot more because it, you know, it looks cool. It looks futuristic. It definitely invites curiosity. But now we encourage our operators that install our chairs to really market the content. Like, people ultimately want to be going on an emotional journey, be told a good story, and it just happens to be in VR. So,
I would imagine.
But yeah, we do sometimes feel like. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. There's always a little delay when we're talking over each other. So, no, finish your thought, please.
I'll say. We always do feel like we're a bit on our own course just because we may get into games at some point, right? But we haven't been involved with the gaming aspect. And so when you look at the industry around LBE, and it's usually about VR arcades, VR games, you know, we don't even have controllers, or we try to stay away from controllers in our chairs, right? Just use, even if there's a little interactivity, use hand gestures. And so we find ourselves in this funny little niche, but it is growing, right? Every major film festival Even Cannes this year has a big competition part in the immersive section. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing more of the narrative creators start to embrace VR more and more every year. So that's been exciting for us.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it is sort of like taking, I mean, the film world, this last year was pretty brutal in the film world. It's very brutal right now in the games world, but it definitely seems like theatrical has been the thing that's been most impacted. But this seems to also sort of like be not exactly a replacement for that, but an alternate variation of that. Like it's a dedicated thing. It's something that you go out to do. It's something that you actually sort of like take the time to. So yeah, I could see that becoming a big, or that, yeah, sort of like it's, I hesitate to say replacing the theatrical experience, but I would imagine that theaters are probably one of your big, you installed a lot of theaters probably, right?
Yeah, we're complimenting it. Yeah, theaters, funnily enough, has been a bit of a up and down, right? So in theory, theaters should be loving this, and we have installed that. We have one at a theater near Yosemite National Park called Yosemite Cinema. It's one of those beautiful VR theaters. They built a whole room out with this beautiful projection mapping. There's a flagship film that takes you on a flyover of Yosemite. They show other content as well. But yeah, we actually just signed a deal with a distributor named DLS, just the largest provider of theater equipment, like projectors, Dolby Atmos systems. Okay. And now they've added Positron to essentially their offerings. And so we're finding a lot of theaters are now wanting that, right? They're asking, look, what can we add in here to make ourselves different, give people a reason to come out to the theater? Because if it's only the movie, a lot of people will just not do that, right? They'll just watch it at home on Netflix. But if there's an experience that, you know, they can get at the theater that's different and includes something like a complimentary VR experience, we find that's a big attraction.
Yeah. So maybe we've only got a couple of holes left here. So kind of shifting, I know we've talked a lot about what you've been doing, but I'm kind of curious to hear, like, where do you feel like things are going? What are you getting excited about? What's the sort of like, what are the upcoming things that are kind of starting to interest you?
Yeah, I think that what I'm excited about, you know, we could talk, I'm sure, a lot about the Apple Vision Pro, for example, right? And what Apple's doing with, you know, of course they call it spatial computing. But I do think that, you know, one thing everybody's trying to Apple Vision Pro walks away with is the wow quality of the visuals, right? In terms of the resolution of that headset, those immersive videos. There's certainly not anywhere, you know, the complaint is there's not enough content, right? You watch some of those things. But nevertheless, to me, it sort of set the bar in a way higher. And that's what I'm excited about. I feel like the Apple Vision Pro finally gets to, okay, this is what cinematic VR should look like. You know, till now, it's always been a bit of the, you know, you get the screen door effect. And of course, people who aren't familiar with the technology wonder, like, why does it look a little more fuzzy? Or why does it, you know, why does it not look like my 4K TV? The Apple Vision Pro now kind of shows a pathway in that sort of investment. So I'm excited about that. And then I think, you know, the cost of content production is going to come down. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, obviously there's generative AI tools and there's a lot of controversy around and fear around AI, but generally I feel like it's just going to unlock a lot more human creativity and the ability for us to be, you know, for creators to be making more content that speaks to their audiences.
Yeah, and I could see, especially because, I mean, so much of the, so AI is something that's sort of like that we've, you know, to be honest, like I feel like I'm probably one of the worst people to speak on it just because I haven't really spent a whole lot of time looking into it. And everything that we do is so handcrafted that we just haven't spent a lot of time really playing around with it. But I know I know that the film industry right now and you're so adjacent to that. I know they're absolutely freaking out about Sora probably being one of the big things. Do you foresee that like having an impact on like what you guys are able to do sort of like in the immediate, or is it more sort of like 3-5 years out that you're thinking that it's going to start to become more?
I think it's both. There's some immediate and then there's going to be a bigger impact 3-5 years. But I would say, you know, the thing about things like Sora and those tools, the fear is like sometimes what people miss is like you still need to know the craft well. You still need to understand good storytelling, good lighting. In other words, it's not just writing a prompt and this movie comes out. Like that's not what's happening. Right. It's more you have to understand how lighting works, how like all the fundamentals need to be there. And then if you've perfected that craft, you can really just leverage those AI tools to really as ways to save time and money. That's how I look at it. It's not like sometimes there's this misconception that AI is like you're just going to prompt things and you get, you know, a film out, and it's not there. Maybe that'll be the case 15 years, 20 years from now, right? But like today, it's really just tools. I was just at an AI film festival that was put on by Runway, which is one of the tools, you know, for creating content. It was super interesting. They had a short films created by AI filmmakers. But, you know, these people all spent, you know, weeks or months making their film. Again, it wasn't like a prompt just turned out a movie. It was trial and error, experimenting with a lot of things. And, you know, you're starting to see the beginnings of possibilities of things that, you know, you wouldn't be able to use to do without a much bigger budget. So that's what's exciting for us.
And that's, I mean, that's always been, that's what we've been finding as well, is that whenever we go into something that we have a very specific idea of what we want to get out, we usually tend to sort of like, we'll play around with Midjourney when we're sort of like coming up with ideas. But usually what always happens, and apologize if I said this on the, on one of these podcasts before, or told you about it, Jeffrey, but it seems like what always seems to happen most with Midjourney is that we will like try to get it to do something, and then at a certain point we realize that it's very rare that it can give us what we want if we have something in our heads. But usually what happens is that if a couple of us are playing around with it, we realize that the three of us or four of us that are sort of playing around with it, we realize what each other is thinking just by trying to see what they're prompting. Right. And then you realize, oh, what if you tried this? But then at a certain point, then it's like, okay, well, now we don't need it to give it to us because it solved that goal of sort of like almost being the rubber duck that we were, you know, putting the idea up against to sort of like see, and then just getting everybody on the same page that still sort of filled that role, basically.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I think it can work as a great pre-viz tool, you know, or a great sort of like, let me kind of map out some ideas or experimentation. But then, you know, the actual like handcrafted work often still has to be done and come after that.
Ooh. But the amount of handcrafting and sort of like the it still really does need the eye of an artist. And I mean, if anything, the thing that I could see it sort of like starting to replace, it's going to be more of the one-off. Like I know, I mean, for folks who make their living doing sort of like stock photography like anything that's sort of like in that vein, like it feels like that's going to be one of the things that's most likely to be replaced. In fact, I think one of the few places that I think that we as a company have agreed that it is okay to use AI is in PowerPoint presentations, or if we're doing slides for when we're talking to, talking to the rest of the company, we've.
Exactly. Yeah. And I personally think that actors are not going to be replaced. I know there's a lot of fear around that, but you know, as a director, I think other directors agree, like they're into, especially like, you know, drama and actors come from theater. It's those little unexpected turns, or sometimes what we call the, you know, wonderful mistakes that create some magic, right? And I think AI is just not going to do that. That's where the human organic element's always going to win out in terms of creativity and what really resonates with an audience. Maybe use AI to, you know, fill in a voiceover or some, you know, replaces ADR. Right. And I think there's like techniques like that can save money, but in terms of like human actors, I think we're always going to still want those to
I am kind of curious, even going back to that, like stock footage idea. I do wonder if some things where it's like, where it's not a film, but like a commercial, it's like every time you see like a pharmaceutical commercial, it's always sort of that stock footagey type stuff.
I almost
wonder if that might be a thing. And I guess one of the things that I'm a little sensitive to, and maybe one of the fears that I have around that, is that I feel like there is absolutely the possibility of it replacing some jobs that are great introductions into the industry, if that makes sense.
Right.
Or sort of like how things work of like even in the VFX world, like rotoscoping is a lot of people, that's the first job so that they're able to you know, sort of like gets their foot in the door, and it's, you know, yes, you need to be able to learn how to do it, but it's more about an excuse to sort of get in. Then again, I also feel like there's going to be other things that pop up, but it definitely feels like we're bracing for a weird time where it's going to be unclear, and different people are going to have different ideas of how things are done, and it's going to unsettle things for a little bit.
Yeah. I think to your point, yeah, I mean, I think learning the traditional techniques is still going to be so valuable in terms of, you know, like there's always going to be an artist or a craftsperson needed at the helm to produce great quality work, even with AI tools. You know, I compare this AI revolution, it reminds me a little bit of when I started making films, is right when sort of the advent of digital video showed up, right? The first mini DV cameras. So when I was studying film, like we were, you know, still shooting things on 16 millimeter and learning about, you know, different film stocks and interior and exterior, you know, tungsten lighting and things that you don't have to worry about as much with digital video. But all of that really helped so much inform shooting digitally, you know, once those tools came around. You can understand. I feel like it'll be the same now, right? Good.
Yeah.
Artists and things are going to need to know there's traditional techniques to make use of AI tools that will give them what they want.
Yeah. It replaced things, but there's also so many kind of new formats and new sort of like types of film and TV that just couldn't have existed like just the pain of shooting film was so great. And you had such limited amounts that you could shoot that you really needed to be able to just record for an hour or 2 hours, like much documentary stuff that simply wouldn't have been able to exist before then.
Exactly. Yeah. And you think about like these technological evolutions of storytelling, you know, like the Matrix movie came out, that first bullet time effect that was replicated so many times. Then obviously there's visual effects that are done today that wouldn't have been possible 20 years ago. So I think what's exciting is AI, hopefully it's just going to be empowering creators to do things that we've never seen before and in different ways. That's what I'm excited about.
Totally. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking some time and playing around with us.
Thanks for having me. This was so much fun.
Yeah. Any last things that you want to do or plugs or Positron, you've got chairs all over the place. So if you haven't tried one, like I said, it is a really premium experience. Definitely check it out if you ever see one there. And we'll post some links, and they're big red egg shape. They're hard to miss. Once you know about them, you'll see them everywhere as you're out and about. So yeah,
for sure. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much, Luke. That's really appreciate it. Awesome. It's so fun to be here and very excited about what Mighty Coconut's doing. You guys have done a fantastic job with creating this platform and this game. It's just so delightful. So thanks for having me here.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much, Jeffrey. Okay. See you next time.